Good morning. Thank you all for coming out this morning. Originally, we were going to meet at 10 o'clock, but I ended up having a bris this morning, which you can't always anticipate. So we switched it to 11. And you like 11 better? Okay. Some people like evening better. I don't know. We're going to have one this month, one next month, and then one in March. I can't anticipate what the topics are going to be, because the whole point is that they are current events. Okay, but we plan to have, this is a three-part series once a month, January, February, March. And of course, this topic today of the Syrian refugee crisis, I wanted to look at it from a perspective of halacha. Insofar as, if we were running the show, meaning if Orthodox Judaism was running the show, and we were faced with this humanitarian crisis, right, civil war in Syria, or not that any war is civil, but a war between similar parties in Syria who have just slightly different, significantly different ideas about who should be in charge and whatnot, which creates a tremendous humanitarian crisis. So what would be the nation that we're running, what would be our responsibility with respect to taking care of the people who are caught in the throes of the violence which is surrounding them? We have in the Torah a very important principle, and it's in Parshas Achrebos, in which the Torah tells us that K'maseh Eretz Mitzrayim u'K'maseh Eretz Kanaan, like the ways of the people in Egypt and like the ways of the people of Canaan, from where you're coming from to where you're going, you're not supposed to be like them. V'chukoseihem lo selechu. Don't be like them. Don't follow their ways, etc. Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, in his commentary on that section, he talks about how what does it mean in general to not follow their customs, and he speaks on the one hand of social behavior and the concept of their customs, of not following their customs, is an instruction regarding private conduct in the lives of individuals and families. But he goes into more detail when he explains that the way in which the Jewish people are supposed to conduct themselves is in the following manner. He says, only a family life of moral purity can produce a people that will champion justice and righteousness, and only a people that practices loving kindness and justice can produce people who are morally pure. Hirsch is looking at the Egyptians and the Canaanites of the days of old, and he's saying that the way in which they conducted themselves, the lives in which they lived, the ways in which they taught their children, was antithetical to everything that Abraham modeled for his family and for future generations. Abraham, God says in the book of Bereishis, I know about Abraham that he's going to teach his children la'asos tzedakah u'mishpat, to do righteousness and to do justice. And using that model, Hirsch says in the pasuk in Acharei Mos about how we're supposed to conduct ourselves, that we're supposed to live a life which is morally pure, because that creates within us the purity that makes us the utmost and the most special human beings. And I think that in general, when it comes to the concept of a humanitarian crisis, the Torah instructs us to look out for the indigent, to look out for people who are needy, and to do whatever we can to ease their plight. And that is a significant Jewish, I'll call it a high road. And when we talk about the concept of, and I don't like to use this buzzword because I think that it's misunderstood by the people who turn Judaism into social justice. That's not what Judaism is about. It's what some people think Judaism is about. There is a morality which Judaism preaches, and there is a concept of looking out for others, not just the poor among you, but the poor not among you. Tzedakah has to go to your people first, and then after you've taken care of your people, then you take care of others as well who are not necessarily Jewish. People do not have to be Jewish in order to be helped by us. And I think that in general, just to bring the state of Israel as an example, The state of Israel knows this so well, because we know, because we're in tune to what Israel does when there is a humanitarian crisis. Think about an earthquake in Nepal. Think about a tsunami. Think about hurricanes and whatever devastated Haiti, etc. Just around the world. What does Israel do? They fly in hundreds of staff, millions of dollars worth of medical supplies. They set up field hospitals. They deliver babies. They take care of people who are injured. That is what Jewish people do. And it's a tremendous credit to the state of Israel that when it comes to a humanitarian situation, which comes up, that they are at the forefront, not sending money to corrupt organizations that are going to misuse the funds, but they get in there, boots on the ground, medical boots and helpful boots, in order to help. That is a phenomenally Jewish idea, and it sets the standard, which nobody else follows, in the same way that Israel does. Absolutely, that is the case. What? And you don't hear about it on the news. Correct. So maybe our next current events topic will be, why does the news hate Israel? Okay. All right. So the next, we'll have to have two sessions on that one. Right, okay. One in the morning and one in the evening. Okay. Maybe we'll do back to back. All right. Anyway, so the big question which comes up, when it comes to looking at this humanitarian issue, is it's great to be able to go to the place where the people need aid and to help them. That's certainly one possibility. But in the case of the Syrian refugees, they're displaced, and being in Syria is not safe for them. It's not, and that's the reason why they're ship packing up, shipping out, and trying to find a place which is safe until the unrest settles. Of course, when the unrest will settle, nobody can know, and therefore, where can we find the right place for them? And by we, I mean the world at large, who is looking to help for those who are absolutely desperate. So one of the comparisons which has been made with reference to the United States in particular is World War II. Now, of course, using World War II as an example is not a very good example for the United States, because, as we know from the stories of our ancestors, and I don't mean our ancestors, I mean one generation, two generation back, the stories of ships that were turned back, quotas of immigration, and people who were sent back to their deaths, because that's what was going on in Europe in World War II, is honestly, it's a stain on the United States in terms of being helpful to the people at that time, and most notably to the Jews at that time. Now, to say that World War II only targeted the Jews is probably, meaning that it only created a refugee crisis of Jews, is probably not historically accurate, on the one hand. On the other hand, we all know the story of the Holocaust and how the Jews were being targeted. But if you look at the numbers, there's a video which maybe some of you saw on the internet that tallies the numbers of people who died in World War II. And the numbers are staggering. Of course, there is no particular population that was targeted the same way the Jews were in terms of genocide. In other words, I mean, I don't even know what Stalin was doing in the Russian side to his own people, but in terms of rounding up a population, the Jewish population, and sending them to concentration camps and committing genocide against them. So in that case, the Jewish people were unique, as we all know. So the question comes is, can we compare what happened to the Jews in the Holocaust, and therefore the need to have open doors for refugees to save as many people as possible, to what's going on now? And so I gave you here a couple of links in section 2A, what is the potential fallout for those who stay behind? So there are three articles here, which I didn't produce for you, but I gave you the links, which you can find. One is from a left-wing website, Politico, and the other two are from more right-wing. And you just look at the headlines. Yes, it's fair to compare the plight of the Syrians to the plight of the Jews, and here's why. Okay, that's the political side. And the New Republic and the Breitbart article, the problem with comparing Syrian and refugee and Jewish refugees, or why Syrian refugees are not like Jewish refugees, looks at it from a different perspective. So obviously there are different viewpoints out there, and in comparing them, we can just look at some of the similarities and some of the differences. One example is, and of course, anytime you're going to look at something and try to analyze it from a perspective of halacha, you have to do your homework to find out what's called the metzius. You have to find out what's going on the ground. And in this particular example of comparing the refugees to the Holocaust, again, to look at history in terms of what was done, no good examples, okay? Because with the exception of maybe one or two countries in Europe, I think Denmark was saved its Jews. I just read an article about the King of Morocco who saved his Jews during World War II. Okay, so we give credit there, but otherwise, you know, everybody else was giving up their Jews. Okay, so I'm talking about in Europe area. So in South America, Central America. Okay, Orient. There you go. See, he shows my geography. I used to take a map test in fifth grade. So what do I know? Okay, but far away from Europe is a different story. We know that Hitler wasn't going to the Philippines and saying, "Give me your Jews." He wasn't going to to Colombia or to Puerto or to Cuba and saying, "Give me your Jews."
Japanese.
Okay. In any case. So what are some of the differences? So of course we know that in Europe at that time, the Jews were being rounded up to be exterminated. Is that the case in Syria? Not saying that it's a safe environment for those who live there, but are they being rounded up into concentration camps and being exterminated? I don't think that is the case. Another example that I saw in one of these articles is in terms of who's there receiving them. When they get to the country of to their destination where they're looking for refuge, are they being taken in by people who can take them, who can give them jobs, who can give them an opportunity to advance themselves, or are they not? So in the case of the Jewish agencies at that time, many people had family members. There were significant numbers of people who would have taken the Jews in. That may be the case now, but in one of the articles that I read, it said that 90% of people who have been in similar circumstances who might be able to house those who are coming in are on food stamps and government assistance. So that's not the same as people who would bring in refugees and give them a possibility to make a life for themselves in this country. Another example is the question of assimilation. Because when people come to a new land, how much are they willing to embrace the culture of the new place, or how much are they willing to not do that and to create their own environment, which is a different question for American society in general, which I don't want to go into, but it's just one of the questions which is raised. On the other hand, to say you have people on boats, and if they're not taken in, who knows what could happen on the boat? People can get sick. There's illness. The concept of the humanitarian crisis in that respect alone. It's clearly very similar and needs to be taken into consideration. What is the potential fallout for the nations to where they come? So I saw an article that was just put on the internet over the weekend, which I put here, in BA, "When Worlds Collide, Unassimilable Muslim Migrants Crash Europe's Fantasy Islam." And if you look at the URL, in the case here, which they changed the headline, but it says Cologne, it's a city in Germany, "Rape, Jihad, Muslim Migrants, European Fantasy, Islam." And the article goes on to describe how there are people who are of this, the refugee mentality, who are in their own way challenging the culture of the countries to which they came. And so, the potential fallout, if you compare the Jewish people at the time to those who may be coming out. Now, obviously, it's not true for everybody. I don't think that anybody is going to assume that all refugees are the same and everybody is equally dangerous and whatnot. But I don't think that this was a type of concern that anybody had in a big adol, in a greater sense, with Jewish refugees. What were they worried about? Culturally, they don't speak the language. Who knows how they're going to change our society? Okay, and the same thing could be said for people who are coming from Syria. Not to say that all people who are coming from Syria are Muslims, not to say that all Muslims are rapists, and not to say that the same is true with regard to the Christians from Syria. But it is a question which is clearly being dealt with in a city in Germany, and therefore, and I have heard similar stories about what's going on in France. So when you look at the metzius, when you look at the facts on the ground, these are some of the different considerations that need to be taken when asking ourselves, do we take these people in? To what degree do we help? What is our responsibility? There was an article a few weeks ago about how the last Jews of Syria were taken out of Syria. They escaped some covert operation sponsored by, I don't know if it was the Israeli government or people in Israel, to bring the last Jews of Syria out of Syria and into Israel. And of course, when you look at that, we're reminded of what took place in the months following the establishment of the State of Israel. When you think about how 800,000 Jews or more were kicked out of the Middle Eastern lands and absorbed into Israel, it took some time for some to be brought in. I mean, they were living in tent camps and eventually to be brought into society. But you look at that and say, how many people, I mean, people remember being part of that that group of refugees from the Middle Eastern lands and from the North African lands. They remember being refugees. They know that Saba and Safta were refugees, but everybody's assimilated into Israeli society now. And even if it took a decade or so, that's the way it is. When you look at certain neighborhoods certainly we're familiar with this with France. It's now the anniversary of the shooting in the kosher supermarket in France from a year ago. I think the anniversary is, if not today, it was yesterday, but it's certainly this week. So we're aware of what's going on in France in terms of some of the no-go zones and the laws in which the laws of the land which are not being followed, and how in some cases French authorities, the French police, don't even go into those neighborhoods because it's being governed by law of a law of a land which is not France's law of the land. So what does that mean about assimilation into French society? Certainly there are many Muslims who speak French and who have a acculturated themselves somewhat to the land of France. I think one of the police, if I'm not mistaken, that was killed outside of Charlie Hebdo last year, also around a year ago, was a Muslim. So just goes to show that it's not a faith itself doesn't indicate that people are good or bad, though clearly the concern in this particular case is that since the people who are the most dangerous today in terms of terrorism are, if not 100%, certainly 99% of the time, people who identify with Islam. So that is a concern, and that is a question which needs to be dealt with by those who are bringing in the Syrian refugees. So with all that as a background, and with understanding that the circumstance for the people themselves, for the individuals, is of course difficult, so now we have to ask the question, how does halacha deal with a situation such as this? And believe it or not, the Shulchan Aruch actually has a siman, a paragraph, which deals almost directly with this concept. This is what the Shulchan Aruch tells us, and it's in siman Kuf Nun Ches in Yoredeya, and it says the following. It's the title of the section is called Din Ovdei Avodas Kochavim Latzilam Mehamaves, the rule with regard to idolaters to save them from death. So I want to make a side point, and this is although it's not an insignificant point, which I put here as 3C. So I'm just going to skip around in the outline for a little bit. Is the question of whether the people in this circumstance are idolaters? Now, generally speaking, when it comes to Islam and when it comes to Christianity, and the refugees in Syria are, from what I understand, are primarily from these two faiths. So we have to ask ourselves if the faiths of Islam and Christianity are considered to be idolatrous. And the truth is that amongst the poskim who address this, there are different viewpoints. There are different viewpoints, and I don't want to go into the details now. There are those who say yes, but there are also those who say no. In Islam, it's a lot easier to understand how it's not idolatry, because they believe in Allah, which is God, and Muhammad as a prophet. So our viewpoint of idolatry is anything which has multiple gods. Multiple gods, worshipping idols, worshipping a sun, worshipping a moon, whatever that may be. That's avodas kochavim, that is idolatry. When it comes to Christianity, the question is a little more complicated because of the concept of the Trinity. But the question is, what does the concept of the Trinity mean? Does it mean three gods, or does it mean that mean that you have God, and you have a Son of God, and you have whatever the Holy Spirit might be? So is that considered to be idolatry? Do they worship the cross? Do they bow to whatever's on it? Or is it a symbol, in which case, but they're really worshiping God? So again, the viewpoints are, they're both out there. One is that Christianity is idolatry, on the other hand, that Christianity is not. And in the event that it's not, then the rules which I'm about to read to you don't apply in this situation. And, of course, we also have to remember that when the Torah addresses the way we treat the nations of Canaan, we're talking about pagan societies. Right, the pasuk with which I opened from Achrei Mos, that Rav Hirsch had the comment about how you create a moral society by treating people morally and being genuinely caring and doing justice and righteousness for others. Along the same lines, when that pasuk says Kimasei Eretz Mitzrayim Kimasei Eretz Canaan, like the deeds of the people who are there, like the deeds of the people who are there, what were they? They were pagans. I mean, look at ancient Egypt, look at ancient Canaan. You see that they worshipped everything under the sun, including the sun, and so therefore, when the Torah talks about how you're supposed to treat those people, the Torah is talking about these particular kinds of groups. The Torah has another set of laws for a group of people called Noahides. And Noahides are those who, among other things, in terms of the way that they practice, they have one God. If they, you know, they believe in monotheism. Right? What are the three big rules that the Noahides have to follow? Are not to commit murder, not to steal. I'm sorry, avodah zarah, gilui arayos, and shfichas damim. Excuse me. It is immorality, right? Sexual immorality, and avodah zarah, which is idol worship. So if we use the example that I gave, the article that I just found today, about the potential fallout for the nations to where they come, so they have a problem. You're not a Noahide if this is your culture. And the question is it the culture? Is it a culture of rape? Is it a culture of mistreatment of women in that regard? And, you know, the jury's out on that one, on account of the things which we're all familiar with, that we've heard of from different Sharia-run countries, in terms of how women who are even accused of adultery are treated, whether they're guilty of it or not, and this headline says a lot about where this is coming from. Is it to say that only Muslims are rapists? Khalil v'chas. I mean, of course not. We are many. Unfortunately, there are sick people in the world. Excuse me. And this is what they do. What some sick people do. But with that having been said, when it comes to the concept of avodah zarah, so it's only those who worship multiple gods who fit into the category of being non-Noahides and therefore of the seven nations of the land. So when the Torah says over and over again that when you get to the land, you have to destroy the seven nations, so it's referring to the nations which are, excuse me, the Kanani, the Chiti, the Emori, the Prizi, the Yevushi, the Chiti and the Girgashi. Those are the nations. Do those nations exist now? No, they don't. Okay, when it talks about destroying Amalek, does Amalek exist now? Is there anybody who can stand up and say, yes, I am an Amalekite? No. We have the concept that when Sanherib came and Bilbel es Ha'umos and divided people up, so we don't know who is what anymore. In other words, all those ancient nations from the time of the Torah, they don't exist. Nobody can come along and claim that they're from that nation. So the rules which particularly apply to pagans and specifically to those nations of the land of Canaan at the time would be very difficult to follow through with today. But this is what the Shulchan Aruch says: Obdei Gilulim Mishiva Ha'amimin, those who worship idols from those seven nations, She'ein Beinenu Beneihem Milchama, when there is no war between us and them. Okay, and that's exactly what this story is. Are we fighting with them? Is America fighting with Syria? Don't answer that question, okay? Is America fighting with Syria? Is Israel fighting with Syria? I mean, Israel doesn't have a specific fight with what's going on in Syria. Anytime Syria turns their guns around and shoots it at Israel, that's a different story. Israel's going to defend itself. Like Rabbi Berman pointed out, at least to me yesterday, I don't know if he mentioned this specifically, I think he may have mentioned it, but that Israel is a defense force. It's not looking to attack Syria. That's not Israel's goal. It's a defense force defending Israel. So let's assume that this applies. Ein beinenu ubeinehem milchama, and there's no war between us and them. He says, Ein mesavavin lahem amisa ve'asur lahatzilam imnatu lamavis. Okay, we don't particularly go out to kill them. Okay, again, I made the disclaimer. Who are we talking about? We're talking about the seven nations who are pagans. Okay, we don't go out to kill them. The asur lahatzilam im natu lamavas, and there it is forbidden to save them if they are almost going to die. And what's the example that he gives? Kigon shirah echad meyam shenafal layam enu ma'aleu afilu im yitain lo schar. If somebody from this nation that we're talking about falls into the sea, we don't save the person and take the person out, even if he's going to pay you. Lefikach asur l'raf osan afilu b'schar im lo hecha de'ika mishum eva. And therefore, you can't heal this person, even for payment, unless there is a principle or a concern of what's called eva. Okay, now, eva is a very important phrase, and it's for us to understand, because it actually plays into our practice in a number of different ways. And I'll give you an example, which I hope we can all relate to. One of the debates that we have in Jewish law is about organ donation. Hey, organ donation, are you allowed to ruin the body in some way after a person dies and take out their organs in order to give it to somebody else? So there are, of course, different viewpoints out there, but there is an organization called the Halachic Organ Donor Society, which recommends for people to sign up to be an organ donor, with two ways of defining death, because there are different viewpoints of how you define death. One of them is based on brain death, right? when the brain stem is severed, or where there's no oxygen going to the brain, so brain death. And the other one is cessation of the heart. And I've heard Rabbi Moshe Tendler say on a number of occasions that if Jews want to be organ recipients, then you have to be willing to be organ donors. Okay, and I think that everybody understands why that would be. Because if people find out in the not-Jewish world that the Jews, oh, they only take organs, but they don't give, then guess how easy it's going to be for the Jews to get organs. Okay, and we know, just like everybody else who needs organs, that, you know, this is not the type of thing that you want to be judged on based on your faith. You want to be judged on based on need, but if your faith becomes an issue, then obviously that would be a deterrent. So we don't want that. And I think that Rabbi Tendler is right in that respect. And of course, in terms of the definition of death, so that's a topic for figuring out halachic organ donation and how that's supposed to be done. But the principle which comes up when you understand that two-way street, it has to go two ways, is the concept of eva. Eva means hatred. That if the non-Jews are going to hate you because of the way that you're conducting yourself, then you have to conduct yourself in a way which is not going to make you look hated. So when it comes to this particular example, another example which they give in the halacha here is if somebody falls into a well, okay, do you have to throw down a ladder? So the answer is good luck, you know, for the Shiva Amin. Okay, now, by the way, we have to understand why for the Shiva Amin, for the seven nations, we have this halachic principle. Why? Why do you have to destroy them? Why? Why is God so stubborn about his honor and the idea that people need to be monotheists and they have to believe in God only and not in... So I can't get into God's attitude in terms of God's ego. It's a different discussion. And it's of course, a very deep theological and philosophical discussion in terms of understanding why God doesn't want polytheism or paganism and why God only wants monotheism. But there is a... And I certainly don't need to explain to a room full of Jews why our monotheism was the cause for the longest hatred of over 2,000 years of anti-Semitism, in which Jews were killed just because we were Jews. So we understand where we're coming from. But what we don't understand is the concept of paganism and how antithetical we were, or our way of life was, to whatever they were trying to create. And how all they wanted to do was to destroy us. And we know in the Torah, somebody's trying to kill you, you kill them first, because your life is more important. So when it came to the people who were pagans, and that attitude which they had, this is halacha. Halacha says, you want me dead, so I have no, listen, I'm not going to kill you, but I don't have an obligation to save you if your life is in danger. Unless, when the situation is reversed, then my life is going to be in danger, and that becomes eva. So if it's eva, then fine. I'll give you an example that from World War II. It's an interesting book which I read a couple years ago called A Higher Calling. Very fascinating story about an American B-2 bomber that had a crew of 10, and they were shot up in the sky, but they were still flying. But their guns were out, and the plane was essentially a wreck on wheels in the sky, and a German pilot who was looking to get another destroy, not a kill, but a destroy. So he saw them, and before he knocked them out of the sky, he wanted to see why they weren't shooting at him. So he flew alongside them and saw that they were really out of the fight. So he escorted them out of Germany, and out over the what's the waterway above? No, basically into the English Channel, and it recommended them to go east towards Norway, and instead they ended up going back to England, and they survived. And the two pilots met in late 90s. So it's a fascinating story. But anyway, in developing the story about this German pilot, one of his comrades said to him, "When you shoot at a plane and the pilot ejects, what do you do to the pilot?" And his response was, "Shoot him." He said, "No, your job is to knock planes out of commission, not to kill people. Because if they find out that we're shooting their pilots, guess what they're going to do when we eject?" Okay, so it's the same concept of Ava. You don't want them to treat you that way, so you don't treat them the same way, and this way they won't do that to you. So when it comes to this, the Shulchan Aruch, in addressing this, says you don't want them to treat you that way, then you don't treat them that way. However, if it's not going to come to that, and it's a different conversation, then you don't have to help them, you don't have to treat them. Okay, that's with regard to the seven nations. So is that applicable to today? And I think it's not applicable to today. Certainly no Jewish person in their right mind is going to advocate, "Oh, there are Syrian refugees coming out of Syria. Let's knock down the boats that they're on. Let's sink those boats." I mean, ridiculous. That is certainly not a normative Jewish thought. And the question is, do we have the obligation to help them even though they're out there? So I think that the example which has been given by Israel in general, when it comes to going to places and helping out, is certainly applicable. And if that were the case, if that were the need here, then that would apply. However, take a look at in halachic views, Jews in similar situations. So Abi Iban's line. So when Jews in similar situations, I brought the example of the Holocaust before, and how. But clearly, Ava was not a concept for whichever countries didn't take in the Jews, because the Jews, there was no way the Jews could have taken them back. So for them to send Jews back to Germany, there was no way that it would ever happen. When was America subject to a Hitler who's sending people to Israel, and Israel saying, "You can't come in"? Not happening. So you see how when the shoe is on the other foot, they clearly made the choice to say that we're not going to help. We don't have war with the Jews in Europe, but we're not going to help, and whatever happens to them, happens to them. Yes, sir?
On the same subject, there was an article just a few weeks or a month ago about Israel sending special forces across the border to Syria, because people have been treated, they bring them back to Israel, they treat them, and then they send them back.
Okay.
This creates goodwill.
Mm-hmm. Right, so that goes into the idea of helping them in their situation. So here, there's an interview which I highly recommend you watch. It's on YouTube. It's an interview with Abi Iban in 1958 with Mike Wallace. Was that 60 Minutes?
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so 60 Minutes. And there are two times when Wallace comes back to the refugee issue, which of course is still relevant today, for reasons which are also familiar to us. But Abi Iban says, in his awesome and amazing and articulate English, he says, "Yeah, the refugee crisis which is there is of the Arabs' own making on account of the fact that they refuse to take their own people in. Why would you insist that we, the Jewish people, destroy the demographics of our fledgling country and make them the majority very quickly when they would sooner and much more reasonably fit in with people who are of a similar culture and a similar way of life in terms of their beliefs, in terms of their faith? And of course, note the fact that the Arab countries around us have 11 million square miles compared to, at the time, Israel's 8,000 square miles of land. And while, yes, there was a lot of poverty in Arab lands at the time, and certainly there was a lot of poverty in Israel at the time, but if you look now, in terms of while there still is a lot of poverty in certain Arab lands, there is a lot of wealth in Arab lands. And to suggest that this is the responsibility of Jewish people to take in the Syrian refugees, Abba Eban was making that point at the time, and I'm talking from a halachic viewpoint. If the Jews were in charge, then would we have to make a similar demand? Help them where they are? Absolutely. Bring them into your land. Is anybody looking at Israel now and saying, no, Israel, how come you're not taking in the Syrian refugees? I think that people, you know, look at the volatile experience of the Middle East and say, you know what, this is not a demand which we're going to be making on Israel. At the same time, and I haven't investigated these facts, but at least from what I've seen I'll call them the right wing pundits who suggest that there are Arab nations who could certainly end this humanitarian crisis and take in refugees, and they could do it in an instant. There are billions and billions of dollars in wealth in the oil states of the Middle East, and yes, they could and they should, simply because they fit into this they fit into the category of having a similar way of life, a similar religion, and a similar just culture to those who are in this circumstance, in this unfortunate circumstance. Right.
But they are not taking any.
Right. Okay. So
funding other people to pay.
Correct. They could resolve the problem. There's to my understanding, there's plenty of space in Saudi Arabia, but they don't want them. They don't want to do it because they don't feel that kindred spirit, which is a question and problematic. Yes. I can't answer for them. The only thing that I can tell you is that the idea of the ADL, just as an example, is to look out for the downtrodden, and because I'm not familiar with that one, but the ADL is very liberal leaning, except for when it comes to, you know, Jews being attacked for anti-Semitism, then they come out and say, oh, no, we're going to defend the Jews. But otherwise, it's a very liberal organization. And so they say, look, Tikkun Olam, right? We have to correct the world. But again, Tikkun Olam is a misappropriated concept which has become the calling card of Jewish organizations who don't understand Judaism and certainly don't understand halacha. And with that, I want to just bring one more viewpoint before I conclude with the last two points. So if you look here in Halachic Views B, so there are three psukim here which I've quoted for you. Two of them have the same word, which is reacha, in them. And this is the question of the hashkafa of the downtrodden. Okay, there are people who are in a dire strait, people who are in difficult situations. So within our way of life, so when it comes to the Torah, I think I once gave a class here about is Judaism a religion which is more, supportive of capitalism or of socialism? And the way which I described it, it's not my phrase, I found an article which essentially put it this way. It said, capitalism with a conscience. Okay, that we are instructed in the Torah to take care of those who are in need. Whether it's the concept of Eved Ivri, the Jewish servant, or the Amar Ivriya, the Jewish maidservant, or whether it's just the concept of V'chi Amuch Achicha, right, when somebody is downtrodden or poor or doesn't have any money, how we have a responsibility to help put that person on their feet and to get them and to give them a way to survive on their own. So that is the conscience side of Judaism. When it comes to these three psukim, which I quoted for you here, number one, Lo Samar Al Dam Re'echa, don't stand by while your brother's blood is being spilled. So the halacha and all the Nosei Kalim, all the commentaries on this section in the Shulchan Aruch that I mentioned, when they quote the pasuk Lo Samar Al Dam Re'echa, don't stand by while your brother's blood is being spilled, they say Re'echa means your brother. Your brother means your Jewish brother. Somebody who is of a different nation isn't your brother. So in other words, you can look at it and say, I can help them as much as I can, but is it my responsibility to defend them? So the answer is no. I don't have to put my life in danger to defend people who are not Re'echa. And if you look at Syrian refugees, I don't think that there's anybody who's going to say, no, these are Re'echa. I'm talking from a halachic perspective. They're not Re'echa. They're not Jewish. Okay, and they're not. I'm not disregarding the humanitarian crisis and the difficult situation and families and all that. But they're not first and foremost Re'echa. So to put your life in danger for them is not a Jewish responsibility. Certainly not, right, again, not to put your life in danger. V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, same thing. You have to love your neighbor as yourself. Who's reacha? Reacha b'mitzvos. The person who has the same responsibilities as you when it comes to mitzvos. Now, does that mean that you can't help other people? I think it's, I've been making it very clear. Yes, you can absolutely help other people. But l'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, to love your neighbor as oneself, is a Jewish concept which refers to how we treat to our Jewish neighbors first. V'chai bohem, you have to live amongst them. You don't have to put yourself into a dangerous situation, which could be detrimental to your health and to your well-being. Now, I say this, and you have to realize. Wait a second. Hold on a second. You know, if you look at what took place in the Holocaust, right, in World War II, right, Yad Vashem is a whole section of dedicated to the righteous Gentiles, to the people who saved Jews. Without them, they you know, we know that there would have been so many more people who were dead on account of the fact that the righteous Gentiles. Now, I don't remember who was the pundit who said, yes, you know, Yad Vashem plants a tree for every righteous Gentile, but on account of all the righteous Gentiles, Israel is not going to become an exporter of lumber. So we have to remember, so it's a very clever line, we have to remember that, yes, there are righteous Gentiles to whom we're very grateful, but look how many people were not righteous Gentiles. So let's you know, keep the delicate balance when it comes to that. But at the same time, I mean, think about, you know, if the Jews hadn't been taken in by people where they were taken in, whether it was the Philippines or whether it was whatever nations that brought them in. So we know that the circumstance could have been so much worse. So when it comes to the humanitarian side, any nation should do whatever they can to help and to save, of course. And from a halachic perspective, we would say that that's the case, as long as you're not putting your people in danger. And that's a very important as long as. So if you turn over the page, which I gave you, you have here the statement which was made by the Orthodox Union about a month ago. And essentially, this is the viewpoint of the Orthodox Union, in which they say, if you look at the last two sentences of the first paragraph, we cannot be naive in our assessment of the determination of terrorists to exploit the refugee crisis, and we should limit immigration to those individuals who share our American ideals and aspirations. So that sounds very much like a cross between safety and what Abba Ibn said about cultural aspirations, which again, Abba Ibn is not a halachic authority, but at the same time, I think that what he was saying is very reflective of a halachic viewpoint. However, we must also recognize that the majority of these refugees are fleeing terror themselves, violence like we have witnessed in Paris, their families, women and children who are running for their lives. We cannot and should not blame them for the actions of an evil terrorist organization. And so, you know, and they go on to talk about the difference between Hitler and the Nazis and this situation. And their concluding paragraph says, thus we encourage a sensible process of reviewing and enhancing security. Neither partisan politics nor xenophobia can have a place in that debate. While security concerns must be paramount, our focus as a nation should be on getting to yes. And I think the Orthodox Union is essentially summarizing in this statement the viewpoint which I think that reflects halacha, which is that when you can help, great, and as long as you're not putting yourself in danger and peril. And that is an important viewpoint to take with us when we look at the question of the Syrian refugees and the crisis. The last thing that I want to leave you with for those who want to take this is a series of seven articles which was written by Stuart Katz on the Times of Israel. I put them together. He went to Greece to try to help out there, and he found a humanitarian crisis that needs Jewish help, and he came to his own conclusions, which I don't want to summarize to you now. You can read it online, or you can read it here if you want to take. These articles were published the end of December, the beginning of January. Okay, and he concludes in the following way. He says, he explained, I'm not going to read all this because you can read it yourself if you take the article. He says, as a Jew, I have an obligation to help. As an Israeli, I have an obligation to help. As an American, I have an obligation to help. As a human being, I have an obligation to help. And he explains why each of those forces the way that he has come to behave. And he says, it comes down to this. This is his conclusion. We need to decide what side of the fence we want to be on. This is what I strive to live by. This is what I learned. This is what was reinforced this week. I cannot just sit here and pretend it's not my problem. I hope you can't either. So we are not in positions in which we can directly influence, you know, U.S. government policy. We're certainly not directing the screening process of the U.S. government. However, in whatever way that we can encourage the conclusion which was reached by the Orthodox Union. We can encourage the conclusions which are reached by Stuart Katz, who was a man who was on the ground and who was helping out in the ways in which he describes in his articles in Greece, in where there are refugee camps, similar to refugee camps which existed in Greece before the establishment of the State of Israel. And so, just to conclude, from a halachic perspective, we obviously look to care for Jews first, because we have to, because if nobody else, because if not us, who will? Right? That's number one. When we can help people on the ground where they are, we should. We have an imperative, and when we're not putting ourselves in danger, we must do that. And I think, as I mentioned before, Israel, as a country and as a nation, has done their part and continues to be a shining model for the world. And in whatever way that doesn't compromise safety of our place, that we can help people who are not a danger to our society and to our culture because they want to join, because they are good and wholesome and loving and family-oriented people and not terrorist-oriented people, then that is a responsibility that halacha would put upon us to say, to do what we can, to be the people who are not like Eretz Mitzrayim and Eretz Canaan, who looked only after their own and didn't respect other ways of life, but to be like who we are, people who look out, like Avram, like God said about Avram, to be people who practice tzedakah, mishpat, righteousness and justice, and to spread the concepts of righteousness and justice to people of the world who are indigent and who are needy. That is a halachic perspective on the Syrian refugee crisis. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
So, if we're going to bring this back to current politics, you can say that Trump's position on kind of slowing down the process by saying no refugees at the moment, or no Muslims at the moment, whatever. How does that stand from a Jewish perspective? Because it sounds like on the one hand, very blanketed and black and white, but on the other hand, it seems like it is a process that has to get slowed down a bit. Because in order to secure the review of, and the vetting and and putting things in place to help. So, when we hear Trump's position, everybody, gets like,
right, so.
And one other part of all this is that right now it seems like there are areas that are already, no-go zones in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And Sharia law has been in certain areas. And so it's almost like two things that have to be dealt with. It's backing up what we already have here,
mm-hmm.
and revising and standing up to what the things of our country, the Judeo-Christian country, and on top of it, you have the refugees that want
to be. Okay, so I think that Trump in general is a sensationalist, and he looks to get headlines, and he's certainly very entertaining. As far as one at a time, okay, and I think as far as just making a blanket statement saying all Muslims, that's coming from a place is coming from a place of naivete. I think that in general, it's not good to generalize. Okay, imagine if the United States had made a policy, no Jews allowed. Okay, you could call Judeo-Christian all you want, but they weren't letting Jews into the country. So I think that there are very definitely people who are needy, and that is an important consideration to be made. But I think that the security concern is a real concern. And to say that, we're going to let everybody in, that's irresponsible. When it comes to the no-go zones in the United States, yes, we see what's happening in Europe. Europe is going to lose its culture. It's going to lose its way of life because they're losing the battle of assimilation. And a nation, listen, assimilating to a country doesn't mean compromising on who you are in your faith. I don't think that any person here doesn't consider himself an American, but at the same time very proudly considers oneself a Jew, and I don't think that that's a contradiction. In halacha in general, until the establishment of the State of Israel, for almost 2,000 years, we were people without a land, and anywhere we were, we followed dina de malchus dina, you follow the law of the land, and you do your thing in your country, but in your neighborhood, and however you want to govern vis-a-vis halacha, but when the law of the land contradicts that, you respect the law of the land. That is what Judaism has always taught. the people who are having no-go zones are not respecting the law of the land. So from a halachic perspective, in terms of the nation, that is a dangerous that's a dangerous perspective in terms of what that would mean for the United States. Yes. Ah, then he knows the Shulchan Aruch. Okay. Okay. You know, his daughter converted to Orthodox Judaism, so maybe she's feeding him some maybe she's That's good, because they're both married to nice Jewish boys. Okay, next. Listen, I, you're not going to get a nice word about her. Right. So I don't. It does, but there are different interpretations, and there are certainly Muslims today, who, you know, I mean, honestly, if you were to ask me, when it comes to like the fundamentalist, and I don't mean the radical, I'm talking about the fundamentalist Muslims versus fundamentalist Christians. I would be, I'm saying the real fundamentalist Christians, not the ones who love Israel and who love the Jewish people and who think that without the Jews we don't have, I'm talking about the ones who really, you know, if you ask a real fundamentalist Christian, do you think I'm going to heaven? Okay, they'll say no way. Okay, you ask a fundamentalist Muslim who's not looking to kill everybody else, do the Jews have a share in the world to come, whatever they believe, I don't know what they would believe, but it's not as bad as the fundamentalist Christian who says if you don't accept Jesus, you're you know, you're burning in whatever. Yes.
If righteous Gentiles had not killed my brother-in-law, he would have perished in Holland.
I understand that, and I said we are grateful to those, and that is why in our own way we also need to do that, but not at the understanding the danger of who we're taking in. Okay, in other words, was the danger for to those who were saving your brother was because of the Nazis, because the Nazis were just the worst people in the world. Okay, was your brother a danger to them? No. And that's the difference. That's the difference. So I don't think that they ever thought, I'm sure they never thought for a second that your brother was going to turn around and slit their throat in the middle of the night. Okay, so, and that's a distinguishing factor which plays into, you know, the safety zone. You can put yourself at risk because this is my country, this is my home, and I can take you into my house and hide you at my own peril because that's a choice which I'm making because you're a good person. But if you're not a good person, I'm not putting my life at risk for you. The Nazis are evil. And I'm a righteous Gentile, I'm a righteous Jew. So if I hide a Syrian in my who I believe is a good person in the United States, and the United States is not looking to kill me, the worst that they're looking to do is arrest either the Syrian or me, theoretically, and not that that's policy. But, okay, so if I believe that this person is a good person, I should take the person in, if I'm such a righteous individual, if I could do that. Okay, all right. Thank you so very much, everybody. Please take some coffee on your way out.